With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Bruce DeTorres on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is World Stage with Bruce DeTorres, exposing the tyrannies and exploring our power with deep dives into history, current events, dangerous trends, and the nature of reality. I became fascinated with JFK about 10 years ago, and all we lost with his assassination. And today we are going to explore an almost unbelievable man, his successor, Lyndon Johnson. Unbelievable in his perfidy, his savageness, his psychology, with author Phil Nelson. Phil's first book, LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination, was first published in 2010, tracing Johnson's entire criminal career, including his presidential years. Then a sequel, LBJ, From Mastermind to the Colossus, was published in 2014, which focused primarily on Johnson's tumultuous reign as president. The third book, by Trinde Publishing, whose marketing director I am, is Remember the Liberty, Almost Sunk by Treason on the High Seas, published in 2017, the 50th anniversary of the June 8th, 1967 Israeli attack on the American ship, the Liberty. Phil's fourth book, Who Really Killed Martin Luther King? The Case Against Lyndon B. Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover, is a reexamination of the original case against James Earl Ray, showing that it was based upon made-up facts shaped to frame Ray. With his blog, LBJ, The Master of Deceit, Phil has continued to document other treasons and murders of other men whom Johnson believed had crossed him or feared that they would expose his true nature. And Phil has presented new evidence that leads arguably to LBJ's involvement in the murders of Adlai Stevenson in 1965, Australian Prime Minister Harold Holt in 1967, and to both Robert F. Kennedy and Thomas Merton, murdered in 1968 through presidential orders to the CIA. I consider him my friend. Phil, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine, Bruce. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. I want to ask, did you come here with anything top of mind, Phil, or shall I put out a couple of questions? What would you like to say first?
Oh, gosh. I guess I could ad lib a few things here. You know, I recently put a suspension on my, not a suspension, but I stopped blogging. I've had blogs for, been writing blogs for 4.5 years, and I felt like I had covered at that point enough to keep everyone with plenty of reading material. And I just felt like I had to devote some time to other priorities that have been slipping for the last several years. And anyway, so I announced that I was going to take a 3 to 6 month sabbatical, but that only applied to the actual blog writing. There will be no more blogs for at least 3, maybe 6 months, and maybe forever. I don't know. However, I am working on other projects. So, in fact, I'm hard at work on being a starting the process of writing materials to support research that is being done by another person, another researcher. And that's as far as I want to take it. But, you know, it's I still keep busy, but it's all on my own schedule. So. Anyway, I was happy to agree to appear here or to join you in your podcast. And I wish you tremendous success in everything you do with this, because you're right on target in so many ways. I loved your book, your latest book. And So I thought I would return the favor.
Well, I'm very grateful. And my producer corrected me when I called this a podcast. This is a radio show. So,
it's a radio show.
But it is on demand. Sure. You know, the links within a day or so.
Right.
Your blog site is LBJ, the master of deceit.com, for folks who want to roll up their sleeves and see what you have commented on over the last many years as a blogger. And we've got three segments together, Phil. So I thought, how's this? The first segment, let's talk about LBJ's rise to the presidency. The second segment, him as president. And then the third section could be the Liberty, Martin Luther King, and everything else kind of current up to speed. And we can go off on tangents into the modern state of the world at any time. I'm just, you know, really intrigued by this man, Johnson, who got on the ticket. What can you teach us about his rise to the Senate leadership, and maneuvering into becoming the vice president?
Okay. I'd like to start off by restating which I've done before in other venues, how I got to be interested in Johnson and what I saw in him. You know, when I was still in high school, I was a sophomore or junior, I guess, in 1961. Yeah, junior. And, you know, it was just 1 month, exactly 1 month after he was signed, after he was inaugurated with John F. Kennedy in January the 20th of 1961, having won just, you know, back in November of 1960. So anyway, 1 month after that, for that whole month, you know, people were wondering. I mean, everybody had learned a lot about Kennedy, but not much about Johnson. And I was sort of keen to understand this guy. He seemed like such a dark figure and sort of, you know, an old school politician, so to speak, and a Southerner, and I guess you would call him Southwest, but. Anyway, 1 month later, on February the 20th of 1961, the news was announced. That was a Monday. I was in school that day, and an announcement came over the PA system that the vice president had, there was an accident. An airplane crashed on his ranch. I thought, that's got my attention, all right. And you know, but not much else was said about it, but other than the fact that they assured us, you know, with the PA system that don't worry, the vice president, our new vice president is fine. He was on the ground, actually. And the airplane just, you know, crashed on his ranch. It was trying to land on his ranch because he had a runway built, I find out later, a complete government expense. The runway, you know, to accommodate a large aircraft. It wasn't a jet. It wasn't a, you know, one of the old four-engine props, but it was a two-engine prop, and it was used by some small airlines. In fact, I worked at an airline that flew those things in 1964, 65. Well, anyway, that just caused me to start wondering about, you know, what is this guy all about? And the more I learned, the more, you know, I came to see that there was some darkness, a dark cloud that seemed to follow him around everywhere. And then I started learning more about his background and so forth. And at this point, he, you know, had just been named the Vice President of the United States. And he'd been a senator for 12 years before that, since 1948. And then he was a congressman before that, since 1937. And, you know, there was just a lot of controversy surrounding him. So, but anyway, he got to that point.
You described in the mastermind of the assassination, his entire criminal career going back to not only, you know, worse than wheeling and dealing. It's really corruption and crimes that specifically I remember the 1948 election he stole to become a senator, right?
Yes, that's right. That was, now I had not learned that, and I hadn't learned a lot of other background, but I, just on a general sense, but until later. But sometime, I think when I was in college, I started learning more about him. And, you know, but well, by that time he was president, you know, so I found out quite a lot about him, and that's, that was rather troubling. In 1964, this is when I was preparing to go to college, and I was working for that airline in Chicago. It was called North Central Airlines. And, well, I met a lot of people there. In fact, Henry Wade flew through there, and I was the one to check him in at the airport. Hmm. He and his wife were traveling to Traverse City, Michigan, and it was late July or August. I shouldn't say late. It was either July or August of 1964, and he flew through Chicago and on his way to Traverse City, Michigan. And when he, well, I don't want to go on about that, but we had some words. This is just before the Warren Commission did its report, and I wish them well, and I hope that they get this thing solved. And we just had a little conversation, and anyway.
That's a definite brush with history. You know, I'm just real intrigued about some examples of his skullduggery before he became president. Phil, do any of them come top to mind?
Well, yeah, it was in 1964 that I first read the book, A Texan Looks at Lyndon. And mm-hmm. and within that book, there it was filled with all kinds of skullduggery, to tell you the truth. Little stuff, you know, it would start out that he would get someone on the hook like Billy Celestis, who he started dealing with back in 1957 or so, 57, 58, or even before that. I'm not exactly sure when it actually started, but that's when it really became more of a criminal operation, because it was just after the passage of legislation to establish a soil bank, they called it. All the farmers, and I remember farmers in Indiana talking about the soil bank and finding out about how the government was paying people not to plant certain crops. In exchange for that, they would give farmers allotments. You could only use so many acres on every farm, and in terms of a number of different things. Wheat was one of them, as I recall. And I think it was, well, I know it was cotton, because that was what Billy Celestis used to fleece the government at mm-hmm. Johnson's behest. I mean, he didn't have the resources. He didn't have the connections to be able to do what he did without mm-hmm. having LBJ assist him in this. So that all started in the mid-50s. And then by 1961, it was so out of control that Billy Celestis's name showed up continuously almost and ubiquitously across the country. Newspapers, radio, television, everything. And so his name was just plastered everywhere. It was basically that connection that first really caught my attention, because having read that book and then also some articles that were in Life magazine that same year, 1964, about his financial rise and how he became so wealthy. Even
only is this Billy Saul?
No, this
Johnson
is LBJ.
Or Billy Saul? Thank you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, here I shifted back to LBJ.
Sure.
And so those Life articles in 1964, and that 1964 book by J. Evetts Haley, you know, really, well, it enlightened me, but in a very negative way about Johnson. And in the meantime, I was also, this is 1965. This is when some of the earliest researchers had come out with startling information about the assassination and how it didn't look like it was possible, given all the doubts and all the anomalies and all the disconnections that everybody should know by now. And I'm not going to repeat all that, but yeah, all that built up slowly. And so in the 60s, when he decided to ramp up the Vietnam War, that's when I definitely decided, I need to get into college. Okay, so I got into college, 65 through 69. I graduated in 69. And just as I graduated, I had gotten an appointment to serve in the Peace Corps. And Phil,
I didn't know you were in the Peace Corps. We're gonna go to a little break right now. We're talking to Phil Nelson about LBJ, the mastermind of the JFK assassination, the first of Phil's books about LBJ, and we will pick it up on the other side. This is TNT Radio.
You should hear what Joe Hoft is talking about.
President Trump, man, you know, he just has shined so much light on the corruption in the government of the U.S. and both parties in the U.S., Republican and Democrat. And I considered myself a Republican for a long time, but man, I don't back some of these guys in this Republican Party at all. Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, many of the senators. And I think the World Economic Forum is really happy that they figured out how they can steal elections in the U.S. because that's what communists do. They come in, they steal elections like we just saw in Brazil, just like we did in 2020 in the U.S., like we did in 2022. Remember, the House was supposed to be 40 new Republican House members. Instead, it was just barely enough to win the House. But it's not going to happen when you have elections that are being manufactured and stolen, votes thrown in that are just not even real people, and signature validations that are turned off, and no chain of custody on any of this. It's just an absolute mess.
Joe Hoft on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of hosts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com. The Congo provides 60% of the world's cobalt. Children as young as 7 breathe in cobalt-laden dust so you can drive an electric vehicle.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We're talking to Phil Nelson about LBJ. Phil, I just want to read you one quick paragraph out of my book, God School, 9/11, and JFK. Johnson was highly motivated to become president. Life magazine was going to print the last week of November 63, an expose written with the help of Robert Kennedy's Justice Department about Johnson's corruption. The assassination caused the magazine to bury that story and to support the new president instead. Had Johnson not become president when he did, right there, he might have been prosecuted for many crimes, including perhaps the murders and sudden deaths of people who had threatened his career, even his talkative sister, Josepha. What do you make of that? And then we'll pick up with you in the Peace Corps.
Well, that's a nice summary of who he was. He was defined by, in my estimation, his ability to deceive others. You know, whether it was one other person, a few, a hundred in an auditorium, or 1,000, or actually tens of millions of people who actually voted him into office in 1964.
Well, I got this from your blog site, LBJ, the master of deceit.com. It's a quote from a magician's son, from Harry Blackstone Jr., who you quote as saying, "I worked quite some time for Lyndon B. Johnson as broadcast personnel, and I think I learned more about the art of deception from him than I did from my father, the magician, the great Blackstone. LBJ was a man who understood the art of misdirection, of making the eye watch A when the dirty work was going on at B, which is exactly the point you just made.
Yes, exactly. That's why that's on the first page of my blog, and the landing page, as they call it, or homepage, whatever. And because it was so important, I think that is the most succinct summary of the man that you could possibly get. And it comes from someone who knew him, worked with him, went to meetings with him, and saw what his methods were. And there are so many books that verify that, and you know, edify it. It's something that, you know, I'm still finding references, still finding old books and old manuscripts and so forth that all say this, all the point in the same direction, and right. That direction is a direction that is so consistent from one right. book to the other, not just my books, but all of the books, not all of the books, of course. There's so many books right, that are written that are intended to somehow yeah. wash away all that negative stuff and only present the good stuff, like, you know, the Civil Rights yeah. Bill and the Voting Rights Bill in 64 and 65. And people don't understand that, but he was such a racist that he impeded that kind of legislation for 37 years. 37 years he blocked. Of course, that's because he was in the South, but he was in the Southwest. You'd think that slavery wasn't quite as much of an issue in Southwest Texas as it was.
You've made this exact point really, really well, that he kind of kept those initiatives and drafts on the shelf, apparently because he definitely wanted to be president all through his political career and did what it took to get on the ticket and stalled as much as he could those beneficial acts while Kennedy was president. And then as soon as he became president, this would be the A in the example of the distraction, you know, these good things, the Civil Rights Bill of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, so he could get the credit to burnish his image as a great president a la FDR, while he was selling out the country and the world to a large degree with what he did in Vietnam for the military-industrial complex. And it is an irony that, as you just said, he was arguably, like you wrote, you know, one of the biggest racists of his time.
Yeah, yes. I mean, in fact, there's an essay by my friend Ed Tatro that can be found on the blog, and he's listed, I don't remember how many, but the numbers, I think it was like 30 or 40 specific bullet points pointing of justifying the statement that he was the biggest racist of his time. You have to understand, before, even though in 1965 he finally came through with this, it was only because he had held it up, being master mm-hmm. of the Senate for mm-hmm. Basically 10 years. Even though he had a 12-year run in the Senate from 48 to 1960, but mm-hmm. since 1954, so that was 6 years, he was the master of the Senate, and mm-hmm. he was supposed to have such grand ideas mm-hmm. and execution of those ideas. And it was all a farce, because what he was doing, he had pent up this legislation, and even before that in the Congress, he resisted it, and finally, right. I mean, he kept pushing through legislation like the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which most liberals and all practically all the black people, at least their representatives, were saying was worse than nothing. Now, that's pretty bad when it's worse than nothing, because I mean, the point was that he was never in favor of anything that would really put teeth into any of these laws, and not, nothing to do with eliminating, addressing the basic issue of having all white male juries in the South. And what would you expect ever get civil justice with that situation? Well, anyway,
one more. It is. Well, finish your point. I'm so sorry, Phil.
No, that's all right. I was winding it down anyway.
Well, I want to read one paragraph to this point about his character and then pick up where we left off. You did talked about the Peace Corps, but I wrote this in my book. I had a 95-year-old neighbor, an airline executive in the 1950s, who briefed Senator Johnson on some issues and saw him at parties. And he told me that Johnson was a world-class charmer and a world-class con man. When a congressman wouldn't vote as Johnson wanted him to, Johnson would pull out a picture supplied by J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI of that congressman in a compromising position, and the congressman would come around. So there's Johnson's legendary effectiveness as a senatorial leader. I want to read the parenthetical note that follows. That same neighbor also briefed Kennedy when he was a senator. And my neighbor said that Kennedy was very impressive. Kennedy would listen and then explain back what he had learned. Most senators, my neighbor said, merely pretended to listen. And he repeated, Kennedy was very impressive. So that was a wonderful conversation I had one day with my neighbor.
I'm sorry.
No, your thoughts.
Well, that was one of many, many incidences like that was basically proving the point that he had actually withheld any support for any civil rights legislation except a couple of attempts in 1957 and 1960 to put something out there that had that name, Civil Rights mm-hmm. Act, but it did nothing. That didn't happen mm-hmm. until JFK came along, and JFK had Robert Kennedy draft the civil rights law of the bill that he introduced, or they had introduced in Congress in, I think it was June of 1963. And that mm-hmm. was powerful legislation. It did what finally got passed under Johnson. Now that Johnson had turned from being 180 degrees against it to being right. the biggest proponent of it, it was always there and was always about his legacy. He was right. convinced that he was, it was his divine right, not just divine right. I mean, it was somehow in his destiny, his divine destiny, that he would become president, because he was just he just felt that he was the only man who could really handle that and do things as great as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and all that. And he wanted to be in that category, in the history books. That's what drove him. But it was his own personal motives.
Yeah. Your books about him are as compelling and as thrilling as Shakespeare's greatest plays about his gigantic characters, Macbeth, Hamlet. That is why you so aptly named LBJ, from Mastermind to the Colossus in your second mm-hmm. book, because he is humanity writ large in all its grotesque, many of its grotesque possibilities. Not to lose our train of thought and to give you a wonderful sense of closure, Phil, do you remember the point you were leading toward when you brought up the fact that you entered the Peace Corps?
Oh, I just mentioned that by way of explaining that I decided in somewhere in there that Johnson was not to be trusted, and there is nothing that he could possibly say that you could necessarily believe. He had a way of saying a lot of stuff, but he meaning not much of it. I mean, he was in 1964. He was still promising that he would, that was the year of the election, of course, okay, in November of 64. So he got to be president by, well, the fact that Kennedy got killed, and he had something to do with it, as I have explained in the books. So he promised all through 1964 that he would never send an American boys over to Asia to do what Asian boys ought to be doing over there. And that was a civil war. And he seemed to understand that, and contrasted to his opponent, Goldwater, who he depicted as a warmonger. And I guess he sort of was. However, Johnson was a bigger warmonger, but you know, it was hidden. The point is, until after the election, and then the early part of 1965 is when everything changed, and suddenly now it's all the bets are off, and we've got to get behind this Vietnam people, because otherwise the communists are going to take over there.
Your two volumes of LBJ are in my opinion definitive, if any books are, and others you're making me remember so many others who observed. I think the Kennedys privately said to each other, you know, he's a man who cannot tell the truth. And JFK had conversations along the lines of, we better make sure I'm real. You know, there's just no way that we could ever let, you know, Johnson become president. Maybe that was discussed when he was pursuing the 1960 nomination. He was apparently forced to bring Johnson onto the ticket. Would you mind, just to bounce around a little bit here, lay out some of the facts that implicate Johnson in the assassination of President Kennedy?
Well, okay, it starts with his obsession to be president, and all the things that he figured he had to do to get to that point. And one of the early proofs, in my estimation at least, is that is when he went to a favorite you know, state senator. I don't remember his name right off, but in 1958, he went to this senator in the state of Texas to get a law change, a state law, that would allow him to appear on the 1960 ballot on both the state and the national ballot. In other words, he was running for two offices.
So he could run for Senate and the presidency in 1960.
Right. Yeah, he was up for renewal in the Senate. And just in case, you know, he lost that, as in running for on the national ticket. And by the way, I don't think he ever intended to run as president. He always wanted to be the vice president, because he had been told time after time by his Senate colleagues, especially some of the Southern fellows, that there's no way he could run as a Southerner and not not a very well-known one nationwide at that, even though he was the master and all that in the Senate. Well, he was convinced. He had convinced himself through them that his only way into the White House would be as a vice president ascending to that office during the term of the president because of the president's death.
I have to reread your books now, because that is such a pungent and horrifying observation.
Yeah, it gets to the fact that all of those who say that no one really decided to pull off this assassination of JFK until after he was president, and after he had made a series of mistakes in their view, things like the peace treaty not negotiated with Russia during his time, the Bay of Pigs, of course, was the very first thing that really got people's attention. And that was because he got aced out by the CIA. I mean, he was fooled by the CIA, and he admitted to that. And
Kennedy appeared weak because he wouldn't use the military to topple Castro in at the Bay of Pigs. He negotiated peacefully the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy had the first arms limitation treaty, the limited test ban treaty, looking all weak, But you're saying, rightly so, that Johnson was conniving all along.
Yeah, he had already acted 5 years before in 1958. He right. was having them change the law because he wanted to be able to be in that position, and right. where he would, I mean, in fact,
I read that near the inauguration when he was becoming vice president, a friend asked, "Why did you give up the powerful majority leadership in the Senate for this weak office?" "Well, son, I'm a gambling man," and something like 4 out of 7, whatever. I'll get it out of my book. You know, presidents became president on the death of presidents. Mm-hmm. We're going to go to a break right now. We're talking with Phil Nelson about LBJ, the master of deceit, here on TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather
with reality and perspective.
Australian researcher Bevan Dockery, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, has asked me to distribute this. Actually, he's asked a bunch of us to distribute this. All I could do is distribute a small part of it here. Fact is that 99% of the radiation absorbed by atmospheric CO2 is in the 15 micron wavelength band, micron being 1/1,000,000th of a meter in length. This equates to the lower end of the cold, far infrared spectrum with a frequency of 20.02 terahertz and a photon energy of 1.33 times 10 to the minus 20th joules. It coincides with peak radiation from a source at minus 80 degrees C, the minimum temperature occasionally reached in Antarctica. So when you take all this into account, and there's a lot more that he has put out here, how is it that CO2 is causing planetary warming? The answer is, it's not. This is TNT climate and weather watchdog, meteorologist Joe Bastardi, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
As an Olympic athlete, I prepare for everything. So when I became pregnant, I thought I was ready. But at 32 weeks, I was diagnosed with severe preeclampsia and had an emergency C-section. Looking back, had I known the warning signs, I would have talked to my doctor sooner. Too many women die of pregnancy-related complications, and most are preventable. If you or someone you know is pregnant or recently had a baby, learn the warning signs. It could help save her life. Hear her.
The conversation continues with Bruce DeTorres on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
With us is Phil Nelson. We're talking about LBJ. Phil, real quick from my book, Johnson said he became vice president and gave up his powerful Senate position because he was a gambling man and 1 out of 5 presidents died in office. I also want to read this. We're talking about what implicates Johnson and Kennedy's assassination. A fingerprint found near the window from which Oswald supposedly fired was determined by analyst Nathan Darby to belong to Malcolm Wallace, a convicted killer who had worked for Johnson. As a young man, Johnson blew up a dog with a stick of dynamite. He beat a mule to death with an axe handle in front of witnesses. He stole the 1948 election that made him senator. He urinated in sinks, defecated in front of staff members, called into bathrooms for meetings, and prowled Air Force One in an open robe, showing his nudity to men and women. His grandmother said he would end up in jail. She underestimated his ruthlessness. Phil, your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm like everyone else who's hearing those words, and that you're just floored by statements that he made and that were witnessed by people, and how he would, and there were reporters who saw him on a number of occasions at his ranch, in a speech. In a speech, he would expose himself, and in fact, once in 1965, I think it was early on in 1965, one of the reporters had the temerity to ask him, you know, why are we in Vietnam? And instead of answering verbally, he just lowered his pants and exposed himself and yelled, "This is why."
Yeah, you know, right. Supposedly showing his big whatever, right?
Well, he called it Jumbo, and I you know, he was very proud of old Jumbo, I guess. And it's an unfortunate predicate, but, you know, he was who he was, and he was a very evil person. You have to understand that. That's the background. He was probably the most diabolically evil person ever in Washington, for that matter. That's a kind of stretch, but certainly he was the most evil president we've ever had. I have a little excerpt of something that the Secret Service agent, the black Secret Service agent who got himself in big time trouble by exposing what the Secret Service was really all about, leading
Abraham
up to
Abraham Bolden.
Yes, Abraham Bolden. And it's about four paragraphs, and it's basically what he has stated, and he confirmed to me yesterday by telephone, that he said these words. May I do this?
Oh, please.
Okay. On or about June 28, 1961, as a Secret Service agent, I guarded the main door leading into the Oval Office. At about 7 p.m., Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson entered the office shouting vulgarities toward President John Kennedy and Attorney General Robert Kennedy, who were waiting inside. Johnson was livid. LBJ accused Kennedy of trying to send him to prison about some, quote, some GD cotton. But it wasn't GD, it was the swear word. Okay, upon leaving the office, LBJ issued a veiled threat to the two Kennedys. The threat was reported to the witness agents, supervisors, to no avail. Quote, he's quoting what Johnson said. You bastards trying to send me to jail? He shouted as he closed the door. The voices became muffled, but it was clear that Johnson was furious. The three engaged in a heated discussion, mostly between Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. The meeting lasted for about 20 minutes. As he left the office, Johnson turned toward the Kennedys, who were standing next to the Oval Office desk, and shouted, y'all better stop effing with me, you SOBs. Okay, that's a quote, but I've modified.
Right. I know.
As he left the office, as he left the office, Johnson made eye contact with the agent, that's Bolden. Johnson's driver was meandering in the hallway leading to the Oval Office. Johnson says, quote, who is that boy standing over there by that GD door? Johnson asked the driver. The driver explained that he did not know the person, but the person would have to be an FBI or Secret Service agent to even stand there. That's his statement. It blows you away. I mean, I've seen a lot of statements, but I've never seen this statement before. And I've studied this, and actually Abraham Bolden, when I talked to him yesterday, he confirmed that he had just sent it out and to a wide audience, I guess, whatever his list is, his mailing list. But he also said he had done this previously, sometime.
Well, I think it's in his book. I think it's in Bolden's book, Echo from Billy Potter.
No.
Okay. Then he has posted it because it's familiar to me. That whole story episode is familiar.
As I say, he did say he had admit that he had posted it or that he had sent it to other researchers, and it's probably on one of the forums, education forum or something. But I unfortunately had not run across it. To have him send it to me and to other people like my friend Ed Tatro and others tells me that he wants to make sure that everybody understands what he himself experienced, what he witnessed.
Yep.
It's powerful and because it comes right in the middle of 1961, that's when all the trouble was going on down in Texas, where Robert Kennedy was investigating Billy Saul Estes and all the fraudulent stuff that Estes was conducting on behalf of Lyndon Johnson. And Bobby was on, or Robert Kennedy was on this.
It was less than a year after apparently Johnson and Hoover blackmailed John Kennedy to put Johnson on the ticket as vice president, or they would expose what they knew about his sexual fooling around. So, so of course the Kennedys would be feeling around about how can we put the screws to LBJ, or at least document it, because that's politics. You know, everyone wants all the dirt they can on everyone possible, because you never know when it's going to come in handy and when you want to drop it.
Yeah. Well, I'm astounded still that obviously when I saw this just 2 days
ago,
I thought, oh my God, how this is unbelievable that I still keep, without even trying, I still get stuff sent to me. But I want to just mention one last thing. Well, not necessarily the last bit. You mentioned I called him Mastermind on the first book and Colossus on the second. And now, if I were to write another book, and I'm not certain I will ever get to that total concept, but in the 145 blogs, 150 actually at this point, that I've written, I've now determined that Johnson should be nominated as the godfather of the modern deep state, because he was among the things he's done.
Yeah, no, that's the latest.
A lot of the program that the deep state is pushing these days, he was the original creator of, such as the global warming agenda, as I've explained in a recent blog. He also elevated the nation of Israel to a direct and close relationship that was tantamount to granting it statehood. His malevolent action in setting up his own ship, the USS Liberty, for a violent attack by Israel on June 8, 1967, which would be blamed on Egypt, backfired when the ship didn't sink, and a very large and impenetrable cover-up was put in place that sealed that secret and further strengthened the relationship. But worst of all, the murderous vice president and his pernicious role as the driving force behind the JFK's murder effectively led the 1963 coup d'etat that transformed the peace-seeking republic that was the JFK administration into what now has to be considered a veritable police state, as once predicted by George Orwell. Anyway, that's all.
Your other book, your third book is Remember the Liberty, which is about Johnson's involvement in that horrific attack on the American ship. And Johnson and his career and the heights that he reached illuminate our bully nature, you know, how might still can make right, and how intimidatable and so many people we all can be in the face of a bully, and how precious and rare it ever was to have a country founded on laws where right would make might. And it's going to take a mass awakening of more and more people to do what this Project Veritas group has as their tagline: be brave, do something. You didn't set out to write these books. You just were compelled, Phil. That's my impression, more or less, right?
Yeah, you could say that, because before I even set pen to paper, back in the mid 2000, around 2006, I think it was, 2005 or so, I had wondered why no one else had written this kind of a book, like my first book. And I decided after all that if no one else is going to do it, then I have to do it. And I was disappointed, but with Robert Caro's, even though his first book was terrific, the second was so-so, but the third was meh, and the fourth one was ugh. This is awful. There's so much missing here. There's so much that's distorted. He actually, in the fourth book, actually capitulated to some of Johnson's worst lies. This is after questioning them and being critical of the very same points in the first and second book. Here, he's capitulating entirely. For example, the lie that Johnson was some kind of a hero in World War II, when he went on a ride on an airplane that got shot at by the Japanese, you know, fighters, he didn't get close to Japanese fighters. He lied about all of it. But yeah. Now here, if you look at the fourth book in the one of the last chapters, you'll see that it was a chapter related to the assassination and portraying Johnson as this great level-headed fellow and playing it cool throughout. That's just a complete lie. He was not cool throughout. He was frantic, and he was doing all kinds of strange stuff. If you read William Manchester's book, then people would understand that. But people right. take everything face value for whatever whatever Mr. Caro puts out there. That you know, it's right. it's very unfortunate because he's out there claiming that he turns every page. You know, he was taught as a young man that he has to turn every page when he's doing research. Do not miss a page, well. And yet. I've cited right. thousands of pages that he's missed, millions really when you count them up. All those newspapers, you know, during 1962, from March through September, for 6 months, right. every newspaper right. in the country at one time or another had these articles about Billy Saul Estes and his right. thievery. Well, right. he missed all of them. Thousands of papers, millions of articles, millions of pages. I mean,
and if I understand the. Attack on the Liberty by the Israeli planes, and it was going to be blamed on Egypt. The U.S. had bombers with nuclear weapons on their way to Cairo, and had the ship sunk, so it couldn't be proved that it was a false flag attack, Egypt would have been blamed, and Johnson would have dropped nukes on Cairo because he wanted to be reelected the following year in 1968, but in his insanity, Cairo, I believe, was backed or stated ally of the Soviet Union. And it arguably could have brought us to a nuclear holocaust as horribly as the Cuban Missile Crisis almost did. Is that your understanding of the situation there?
Absolutely. In fact, those airplanes, two of them, at least two, there may have been three, even four. I'm not sure about that point, but there were at least two that left the, I think it was the USS Saratoga. But anyway, they were 3 to 4 minutes away from Cairo, away from bombs away. That's how close we came. And it's actual fact. It's proven beyond question, not just by me, but by Peter Hounen. Whose research I celebrate and point to. He was the one who found that out. I had the fortune of following him and including that material in my own book. But I hats off to him. But he did such a great job of finding out these details, and many other people, the survivors themselves. I had sent. Some of the survivors, my second book with two chapters on the USS Liberty, and three of them volunteered to help me write a third book that's called Remember the Liberty, and mm-hmm. that was Ernie Gallo, Phil Turney, and Ron Cuckle.
These were guys who were on the Liberty.
Yes, they had personal stories that they wanted mm-hmm. to get out, and with. When I invited them to do this, they jumped at the chance, and yes, I think that Liberty was one of my best books, even though I think the Martin Luther King book, which we haven't discussed here, is actually I believe it is my most breathtaking and I can't even think
comprehensive.
Of
the, it's comprehensive.
Well, it's comprehensive, and it's putting out new absolute evidence of the storyline that I've written. Basically, and here I have to give hats off to Dr. William F. Pepper, because it was his book that came out just at the moment. I'm talking about just the very month that I'm. Getting myself prepared to take on this task of writing a book about Martin Luther King, his book gets published. It's like right. it couldn't have been more, you know, convenient for me.
So it's a comprehensive book. And for those, you know, who love what Dr. King stood for and who love a man like you, Phil, who will do the hard work to bring the information that we desperately need in order to be based in reality and consider ourselves sane, and also understand what we're up against as people who would like to self-govern, who need to be challenged to be brave and do stuff and participate and spread the word about the truth and call lies, and say the emperor has no clothes when the emperor has no clothes. Yeah, people have such a treat in store with any of your books, and I circle back to the LBJ books. Phil, we are out of time. Thank you so much for spending your some of your afternoon with me and my audience, and we will be in touch. And this is World Stage with Bruce DeTauris on TNT Radio.